Congratulations.
You're listening to Congratulations Pine Tree. I'm having a hell of a time. I got to tell you, I'm on one today with Kate Rhodes.
Kate's popping off over here.
And Mason Waswas.
That's right. Oh, thanks for announcing me.
You're welcome.
That was easy.
Got to tell you, we got a great interview on this episode.
Yeah.
I'm very excited about it. This was in my top three, at least. Wofford.
Jennifer Wofford.
Pillar Beacon.
Known by some as a pillar and beacon. Known by many, let's say.
Really excited for you to hear that interview. But before that, let's have a little bit of us shooting the shit.
Kate went to a really incredible panel.
There was our golden event of the month. Who We Be, super panel on art, protest, and racial justice. And I'm very happy to report that I'm pretty sure that it was recorded. So when that becomes available for your listening edification and pleasure, we'll put a link to it on our little website. We got Ben Davis, Jeff Chang, who wrote this book, Who We Be, which I want to go get and read.
Yeah,
everybody
read
go
well.
Get that book, read it. It's about art and activism and stuff. Alicia Garza from Black Lives Matter, who also, did you know, is going to be the, I can't remember the name of the title, but the person who leads the Pride Parade.
Oh.
What is that? The chancellor? The ring bearer?
No, I know what you mean. It's like they have the little...
The
little
spokesperson.
Chairman.
Stephen Thrasher, who is a really great journalist and had amazing things to say. They all had amazing things to say. Did I say Ben Davis and Christian Frock?
Ben Davis and Christian Frock. Is Ben Davis based? He's from New York, right?
Yeah.
That was the one thing you got out of him.
He grew up on a sailboat. Anyhow, point is, the audience for this was also fucking amazing.
And it was moderated by Elizabeth Travels Light,
who was also phenomenal. If I had to give a couple highlights to somebody who couldn't make it, I don't know, man. All five of these panelists were fantastic. I thought Jeff Chang gave a really succinct talk where he talked about kind of like our future in 2042. Supposedly, you know, white people will no longer be the majority in America. And it was brought up later because, like, I think... He was kind of bringing that up as like, maybe that can be our utopian target. Like, wrest control from the white supremacist.
Yeah.
But it got brought up later that, like, you know, the powerful never give up their power willingly.
No, definitely not willingly.
So just because there will be a white minority doesn't mean that the power is going to just somehow...
I feel like
the power is going to disperse.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I feel like often the people in power are the minority in like other countries.
Oh, definitely. He was talking about activism and political movements as a wave and how waves actually don't just happen like through one discrete event. It builds up underneath the surface of the ocean is where waves are created. And so that it's not just in a single event, it's a process. And so like... political change and things like that are a long process, and I think that's a better way to look at it. I mean, they were great. Christian Frock with kind of gave kind of a
rally cry,
kind of just that like there's all kinds of ways, like if you think that there's nothing you can do to help up, like especially she was talking about being a parent of young children and how you can't always go camp for Occupy and how you can't always be present at every single meeting or whatever that's happening, but there's ways, other ways you can figure out to help. But they also brought up, I think Alicia Garza brought up that, like, I'm really paraphrasing and this is just my like fever dream of what happened, but she kind of brought up that it's like important to collaborate. Like you can't just, I mean, how I interpreted it as a white artist was that you can't just be a white artist and like burst onto the scene and be like, I'm making activist art and I'm gonna like represent all these groups that I'm not a part of.
Yeah.
And like all this, you have to kind of collaborate and listen, and like if you're gonna try to help, you have to actually talk to and know the
yeah.
people that you're
yeah
whatever
that you think you're helping.
Yeah, exactly. I think Christian Frock brought up Erin McElroy.
Mm-hmm.
And she talks about her a lot, and that she doesn't think of the anti-eviction mapping project that she does as an art project. She thinks of it as activism. Mm-hmm. Separate from art. And the reason why
Erin thinks that, not Christian.
Right. No, yeah. Christian still thinks that it's a great art project, mm-hmm. which I agree with that. But I didn't realize that the reason why Erin McElroy says that is because she feels like if she claimed it as an art project, then it's like, this is an art project by Erin McElroy.
Right.
That she's like putting her artist identity in front of the project, and then it becomes about her and right. like her career and stuff.
As opposed to about a larger
yeah, exactly.
community being right. impacted.
Exactly. Yeah. So I thought that was also interesting. These are the things that kind of resonated with me as an yeah. artist. The group that put it on, that Elizabeth Travel Site, who moderated, is, you know, I think one of the...
Founder of the Bay Area Society oh, yep. for Art and Activism.
I would definitely recommend signing up for that. They have a book club.
I'm going to sign group. Up right away.
Totally.
I feel like when I go to... I did not go to this panel, but when I go to panels like this, there's always like a sense, like the room gets really like... excited and really like ready to go forth with like action.
Yeah.
You know, and I guess part of sometimes in some situations there have been like tables set up where you can sign up to participate in certain groups, or there's actual sort of action items you can sort of get started with right away. Like, yep. was there any kind of, other than maybe signing up with this group or signing up with a group, or were there any, like, was it about, like, taking action, or was it a little bit more sort of, like, theoretical or intellectual or...
Well, I think anytime you're talking about activism, it's definitely going to be galvanizing to the audience if they care about the causes that the people are talking about. So I think there definitely was that, and, you know, I felt that energy in the room where, yeah. like, at the end of it, everybody wants to, like, get up and, like,
they're,
roar.
Like, ready to, like, take the shit over, which is awesome. It's such a... It's, like, that energy, I think, is so... important.
Yeah.
And how do you hold it? Or well, not I hold think, it, but
yeah. And I've been to projects too where, or like, you know, panel discussions or meetings or whatever, where you like, as soon as you get there, you like sign up your email address, and then you get a million emails after being like, come volunteer, come to this meeting, come right. to this planning session. And like, I think
I'm not saying that's definitely that is the answer, but
no, I think
I'm just curious.
Yeah, no, I don't know, because I think about that sometimes too. But I think what's more important than like signing up to go do something that maybe like once the like adrenaline of the day has passed, that maybe you will be like, I don't really want to bart out to
yeah, I'm just going to go to the studio
Richmond or yeah. Or like, you know, I think what's more important than that is like talking to other people that were there that are also excited, and like forging actual relationships with yeah. other people that care about the stuff that then will peer pressure you into doing the stuff that maybe you wouldn't do otherwise.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's, I was just thinking that it's actually those relationships that are become more important than the, like the quick
like mailing list. Yeah.
Yeah. The mailing list.
Or yeah. The calendar updates. So that's just my two cents. I feel like I made some friends. And I gotta say, I go to these things, I chit chat with people, and shout out to people that said that told me they like the podcast. I don't know though, man, these things I go to and I have a moment always where I'm like, what is my life right now? Because I was like,
because you feel like you're like having
Christian
an out-of-body
Frock
experience.
And I chit-chatted with them, and I, you know, like I talked to Keith Hennessy.
Keep it together, Kate. Keep it together over there.
And I start to feel like I'm kind of like,
I feel like
an imposter or something.
Right. But I don't think you are. I think the podcast has kind of put us in a position, or put you in a position, definitely, of meeting a lot of people in a short period of time.
That's accurate.
You know, which can feel kind of, I'm sure it can feel sort of like, whoa, 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 what, it's like moving too fast, Kate. It's just moving too fast for you. Whereas like a lot of these people I've
yeah, you know everybody.
But I've met them slowly over the course of 10 plus years. Yeah. So it's sort of like, it feels a little less.
But do you ever feel that way sometimes? Like you're, I don't know. I feel like maybe.
I often feel like an imposter.
I wonder if it's like also in the art world, because so much of what we do is kind of, we're just doing our thing. And
do you think like the idea of like illusion is bigger in the art world?
Because everyone's got like magical thinking and stuff like that?
Well, or just that we're all supposed to be doing multiple things that are all amazing. And so there's a sense of like making things up, or kind of like, I don't know, pulling out some magic tricks to make it seem like you're
like beefing up your CV, your verbal CV you tell people.
Yeah. I don't know.
Maybe. I don't know.
So, I mean, I think that's why occasionally I'll feel like an imposter. It's like, well, you know, I just pretty much, I'm working right now. I go to work every day. Guys, what do you think about that? It's a pretty exciting situation. And I mean, sort of, yeah, but it's sort of like, you know, you feel like it's that, it comes kind of comes back to that question of like, oh, what are you doing? You know,
yeah,
what
no,
are you
definitely.
Working on? What
yeah.
are you doing? This happens
because we all have to kind of puff up like our, puff, how important like, we are. Like and so we're all like weird
Facebook
like,
in person. Where you're like, oh, God, here's a really good photo of me. Does that work?
And then you have to like enact that.
Exactly.
Wow. I didn't really think of it that way. I was thinking more just because I'm like some country bumpkin from Ohio come to the big city.
Well, I mean, I guess that's how maybe how you'll feel for a little while because you haven't been here that long.
Yeah, totally.
When will that start to fade? Will you always be like the Ohio bumpkin? Oh,
I don't know. Like I've said before, I used to work as a studio assistant for one of my old professors, and she would take me around to stuff. Like, she would actually have me throw parties in her studio.
Oh.
Yeah, like, organize parties in her studio. And even that, like, and it would just be, like, my other professors from my weird little art school in Ohio. But
were
I would
you
feel
equally,
like,
mesmerized by them?
Yes, and I'd be
out.
Like, I don't belong here. It's like I'm in the adult table of Thanksgiving.
You're, like, in the adult swim lane.
I don't know.
Really, do you really
think
that?
I think you
just
have to internalize it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you feel that way, listeners? What do you think about it? Are you a seasoned art world luminary of 70 years on? Are you a 15-year-old whiling away the hours?
I also think so much of it sort of comes with age and experience.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's like, for me at least, the older I get, the more unwilling I am to just sort of deal with bullshit or to even, well, and bullshit for myself, you know, like just feeling bad about things I'm not doing or, you know, just
yeah.
sort of like get over it. It's okay. You know, like you just kind of give yourself a pass to just do what you need to do at the time. And so
that's what I hear.
That's what you hear right here. You're considerably younger than me. So
no,
we might have we have different perspectives.
I don't consider it.
But in, you know, in 10 years, you might be like a really confident person.
We're out here in a studio again, which is amazing. This is the third artist studio we've been in on our Arts and Culture podcast. So we're here in an airplane hangar talking to Jennifer Wofford. Artist, educator, illustrator, and oddball. Would you agree with that?
Thank you.
Okay, great. I really wanted to ask you about mail order brides / mob. Did I get all of that right?
You are one of the few and the proud. Yes, you got that right off the bat. Yes, we have a mouthful of a name, which is Mail Order Brides / Mob. After you say that, then you can say Mail Order Brides, The Brides, or Mob for short, though.
So could you tell us a little bit about that?
Oh, dear, just a little bit, huh? I've been working with Rianne Estrada and Eliza Barrios, both of whom are artists in their own rights individually as well. We've been collaborating on these sort of, I guess campy would be the word to describe them, performance sort of photographs and videos for coming up on 20 years now. We were brought together for other sort of purposes by our late mentor, Carlos Villa, back in the mid-late 90s. And we were supposed to do a research project together, which we failed absolutely miserably at. But we realized we like hanging out and gossiping and eating together. And that has sort of developed into, well, let's just take some photos while we're doing that. And, oh, well, let's get some costumes involved. So that is basically the slow evolution of sort of that process. We were brought together for what was, I think, in 94, called the Filipino-American Arts Expo. Like every year in the Yerba Buena Gardens, they have this big Filipino kind of general pistahan festival. And in 94, the first year, I think they did that in the gardens when YBCA was still very new. And so they actually had an exhibition within YBCA that Carlos was part of or organized. And so I think somehow through that he had met both Rianne and Eliza through totally different circles, because I think Eliza was in grad school at Mills and Rianne was interning at Southern Exposure, but she was working at Creative Growth. And so then, and I was, I still at the Art Institute as an undergrad, and so he was like, "Hey, I think you need to meet these two girls, and maybe you guys should work together." And then there were two other Filipino Americans, Hope Reyes, who was at the time a really amazing photographer, also an undergrad at the Art Institute, and Maria Medjua, who is now the director of the SF MoMA Artist Gallery. So Hope and Maria kind of ended up leaving the area kind of around not long after that period, but we were all five of us were failing at this research project together. It wasn't just three of us. But then, yes, after they sort of disappeared, and actually in the very, very first mail order bites photo shoot, Maria is in those photos, and they were shot by Hope. So they're sort of still there at the edges of the process, for sure.
Could you talk a little bit about Mananang Google? Did I say that right?
You are two for two. You are nailing it. I'm betting you talked to Patricia Carreño. So I guess around fall 2012, the curator at the San Jose Museum of Art at the time, Monica Ramirez Montagut, was curating this show called This, That, New Stories from the Edge of Asia. So it was mostly Asian American artists. And so she, being fairly new to town and either just completely, divine inspiration, her great sort of wisdom, or maybe she just got steered down the wrong path to us. But in any case, she ended up, meeting with Eliza and I, deciding she liked the bride's work, and basically sort of commissioning us to do a special project. And so for a couple of years, Eliza and Rand and I had joked about wanting to do this project where we were like these terrifying lady executives who were secretly Mananangal, or Aswang is another term, which is easier to say, but why would we do the easy word? But Mananangal or Aswang are sort of interchangeable terms for sort of a Filipino demon lady, like a vampire basically, whose upper body separates from her lower half of her body, and the upper half flies through the night air looking for like babies and fetuses to eat. So it's kind of like, just another variation on the kind of the witch myth that every, village has to kind of make you suspicious of the woman with too much power. Yeah. And that's also a good way to keep the kids in line, So I think something happened years earlier where we tend to joke about doing a project for years before we actually do it. But I think we just got into the sort of glamour of the Leona Helmsley sort of Carly Fiorina look. And we just want shoulder pads, and we want to be kind of scary ball busters and... but then this was all kind of happening right at this sort of moment of, it's not like Silicon Valley hasn't existed. But things are getting a little aggravated here in recent years, as we all know. And I think somewhere along the way, our sort of scary executive lady project evolved into this giant shadowy corporation called Mananang Google. So it did take on a little bit of a tech twist. But I'd say at its heart, the project is way more about people's issues with women and power than it really is about tech, because everyone's kind of... We're already flogging that horse, I'm not sure if it's dead or whether we're just being sort of mean to the horse, but let's just stop that metaphor. In any case, we'll just focus on the whole issues with women and power thing, because that's so much fun.
The first performance you did in the office building, the women's, what was the building?
The Global Fund for Women. Which Eliza Barros was working at the time. So her company actually let us take over the entire office space for a weekend to do this crazy, crazy performance piece.
It was amazing. The women learned power positions, like literal, standing with your hands on your hips. What were some of the other ones? Leaning in, literally leaning in at the conference table. That was a good one. Shaming the men a little bit.
Just giving women permission to take up as much space as possible, and we made all the men stand in a corner off to the side, covering their crotches, looking down with their toes pointed in. And some of the men were really, really into it. Like, they really kind of, yeah. I mean, it was a self-selecting crowd, I guess, who attended this event. I think some folks had an inkling of what they might be getting themselves into. So most folks kind of knew to play along. And we, despite being kind of mean, I think we created enough space for play that I don't think anybody felt like we were really being that mean.
No. So, yeah. And then so you had this most recent performance at SOMARTS.
Yes. So there was this exhibition in January at SOMARTS called Glamourgeddon, curated by Johanna Potig, Angelica Muro, and Dio Mendoza. And it sort of had this generally kind of like glamour apocalypse sort of vibe going on. So what better thing to have as a culminating activity for the Glamourgeddon exhibition than a series of lectures given in the back of a pink stretch Hummer limo. So Johanna curated a number of different artists or academics to give lectures, like 20 to 30 minute lectures in the back of the limo. And so she invited the corporate executive team of Mananang Google to give a lecture. So that is what we did. I should clarify that our idea of a limo lecture involved zip-tying everybody's hands together at the very beginning of the lecture, giving them all sort of corporate sort of souvenir tote bags, which we hung around their necks and then pulled over their heads later, sort of like, because we basically wanted to treat the whole thing like a rendition flight. Then I think at some point or another, they transformed from being our captives to sort of, like, we tried to take them again through this whole Stockholm Syndrome thing of, you know, programming them to be part of our cult, and then we had them doing falcon cries because as we removed the bags from their heads, you know, we were like their falconers and they were our falcons and it was like Falcon Crest and, you know, there was this whole empowerment thing we were trying to get through to them.
Did anyone freak out with the bag over their head?
Well, that's their own problem. They should sack up.
Good pun.
Yeah, there was a little bit. There was some consternation, I think, but I think that was like, what did they expect, a Disney ride? They got their hands zip tied together. They were loaded into a limo, and their heads were covered with bags. There's no, you know, tapping out at that point. You're just in or you're not. So, but everyone was trooper. There was no vomit. Nobody wet themselves, as far as we know. So I think it was. I guess if that's a good thing, that was a good thing.
Did the limo go somewhere? Or was it just parked in front? Yeah. Okay.
We had sort of given the limo driver a route that we wanted them to follow, and so there was definitely some sliding around in the back of the limo as we made them do a sort of a corporate tug of war, and we were on the freeway. So, like some things the CHP may not have wanted to know about.
So is this performance based off of just like, I feel like your performance at the Global Fund for Women was based off of the Lean In book. Was this one sort of formulated around another text or?
No specific text. I think we were just generally still more interested in, I mean, what every good company should be interested in, which is indoctrination. So really just programming our, you know, our potential new hires or our new hires to do our bidding and feel like they're doing it by choice.
You also have a personal practice that's not done in collaboration with others that we know of.
This is true. There's a few different things going on in the imaginary studio that none of you can see right now, which is covered in chandeliers, and we're being served by shirtless manservants, and only the finest champagne going around right now. There's a grid on one wall of some printout pictures from this web project I did in the fall called Earthquake Weather, which was basically me collecting people's stories from the 1989 quake here in the Bay Area, and my sort of ham-fisted attempts to illustrate their already ham-fisted memories. Because, you know, memory is so subjective. But I was really interested in those moments. So it was not necessarily supposed to be this spectacular catastrophe, because the quake was bad, but it was not as devastating as many quakes can be. But I think for me, thinking about 1989 as a sort of a moment of sort of rupture is where this other earthquake work is going right now. Like, I mean, a lot of stuff, hell of stuff happened in 89, not just, you know, the Bay Area quake. I mean, it was Berlin Wall, it was Tiananmen Square. And so I'm just kind of interested in that particular moment of rupture, and I think that's what's leading into the other work now. But I'm still kind of like muddling my way through exactly what that means. But I've gone from doing these kind of small, quick, kind of cartoony studies of people's like, sort of more intimate memories into these larger kind of catastrophic landscapes. I'm right now working on a big painting of the aftermath of an earthquake a couple years back in Bohol in the Philippines. There's another one on the wall, which is an earthquake that happened up in the Chiang Rai area of Thailand a couple years ago. And then there's a smaller study that's going to become a larger painting, which is actually from the 89 quake. That's up. It's an image based on an image from up in the Santa Cruz Mountains. So, and I think there's probably going to be 6 to 10 of these large-scale sort of landscape-ish paintings for the show. But, you know, you never know. Like, I'm such an 11th-hour achiever, and the show is months away. So crazy shit will happen.
Well,
that's kind of both the good thing and bad thing about having a show in another country. This show is in the Philippines, by the way. Did I say that?
No.
Okay, I'm saying it. I will have to be attending to other things that are logistically more complicated than doing stuff when you're in your own hometown. So just procuring paint or dry times or, you know, sourcing materials, just getting stuff, you know, the canvas is restretched when I'm over there. It's not that difficult, but it's just other things logistically that I don't want to overstretch on. So
that's so smart to paint them unstretched and then stretch and then send them and then stretch them. I never thought of that.
I never actually worked on, I've never been like a painter's painter. Like I've, in fact, most I've, I've rarely worked on canvas. I've mostly worked on paper. And so for me, even working on a stretched canvas at all still feels a little weird. So, and I like to travel. So it's always got to be about how you store things and move things. Most of my projects have been able to be stuffed in a suitcase or whatever for ages now. So moving up to something that's larger and might have to be in a tube is a whole crazy new world.
That's a really good tip.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tubes,
I'm going to do that.
My tip for the day is tubes.
I would like to talk about earthquakes. I'm from Ohio.
Yes.
We don't have them. I don't understand them, really. We had that one in Napa last year.
Was that your first earthquake?
That was pretty much my first earthquake. And
how was that for you?
Weird as hell. I probably wouldn't even have noticed that it happened, except that my girlfriend woke me up and was like screaming and freaking out. And I was like, had no idea what to do. And we just like, I don't know. I my instinct was to get up and run outside. Is that a bad idea?
I think you need to talk to somebody who's an expert in painting. I don't know, girl. I mean, there was, it used to be you were supposed to get in the door frame. Now everybody says, no, you're not supposed to get in the door frame. And I think you're still okay getting under a table, but not if it's an IKEA table. Like, maybe if it's, you know, like designed within reach or something like that. But I don't know about, you know, some of those other off brands.
The thing they say about outside is that there could be things flying distances, and that, you know, it's dangerous in that regard as well.
Maybe outside is okay if there's, you don't anticipate something falling on you.
Yeah, like maybe if you're in like a big open parking lot that's empty.
Yeah.
What would you do?
I would find a really big parking lot. I would stand in the middle of it. I don't know. I think I just want to work on my 72 hours preparedness kit, because right now it's still like three cans of tuna and a couple of Kind bars and some pretzel chips and nothing else. Like no water, no, not even a can opener for the tuna cans. So, like, that's going to be fun and could keep me busy for a while. But, yeah, I think, like, many Californians or anybody who, think like, lives in, a volatile zone of some sort, it's depressingly easy to get nonchalant about it, so.
You're also an educator.
Are you still teaching?
Yeah, I taught at Leadership High School here in San Francisco from 99 till 2000.
Park?
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, I was the founding art teacher there. I created the art program. So, but that was kind of like my trial by fire. I started kind of doing teaching actually through Southern Exposure when I was still an undergrad, doing like Mission Voices kinds of summer programs. And so most of my early teaching career was working with, inner city kids, I guess, for lack of a better way to describe it. And then through Southern Exposure and meeting Nancy Hom, I got asked to teach a workshop at Leadership, which led into a teaching job. But so, yeah, the earliest part of, like, I think me really learning what teaching was about was pretty much just being thrown into the deep end of the pool in 1999 with no teaching credentials and no supervision, like nobody telling me, no, that's not how you teach art, Wofford. Being just sort of turned loose to create my own curriculum. It was kind of a dream come true, but in a lot of ways I learned everything the hard way. But so I did that from 99 to 2004. Then I kind of still occasionally substitute taught there for a while afterwards. But, you know, it's a really deep community of folks there. And I think had I not had the kind of teaching experiences I had there and worked with kind of the amazing teachers and students that I had, like I don't know if I would be as mature and grounded as I now am.
It's a totally different bag of, I mean, it's totally different teaching high school students than college. I mean, I feel like you get a completely different experience.
Like you have to actually teach.
Absolutely. And I think around that time, I think there was also for me, it's an ongoing saga that most people who know me know, is that I'm gonna bitch and moan at some point about the lack of diversity in the arts in the United States. And
oh, please do.
I am bitching about the lack of diversity in the arts, folks. But a lot of it was from those years when I was at Leadership, where I would be working every day teaching art, like all day long, to a really, really diverse group of students. And then I would go to the art openings, and it was pretty much like a bunch of white folks and a few aspirational Asians and nobody else. And absolutely nobody noticing that this is not okay or a problem. That there was this humongous sort of racial and economic divide happening, that nobody was actually acknowledging just how fundamentally bourgeois the arts are. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, but it's not an inclusive thing either. So it would make me a little crazy. And so it certainly informed and still does inform a lot of my ambivalence about how I want to move through the art world. It's like I don't really want to be part of it because it feels a little irrelevant. But it also feels like if I don't stick around, shit doesn't change. So I'm kind of like, I always got one foot in, one foot out the door, basically. But yeah, so after that, I did what many public school teachers do, which is I totally burned out. And I just realized that I was becoming that, you know, like many teachers, I guess, I was becoming that person who was giving up her own personal practice to teach. And teaching is a noble thing, for sure. But I just think looking at, again, some of the other issues of gender disparity and racial disparity in the art world, I was like, all right, so I kind of need to get into that mix and actually try to do more things as an artist, not just as a teacher, you know. So I kind of transitioned out of that, ran another arts nonprofit for a year as the program director, and then I went to grad school. So pretty late in the game. I was about 10 years off between my bachelor's and my master's degree, and it was specifically because I kind of needed to figure out how to be an artist. And then I also realized I still wanted to keep teaching, but I could not teach at the next level of teaching, which is college, unless I had the paper. So then I went to Cal, and then I got up, and now I'm doing the adjunct hustle like everybody else is.
So are you at SFAI? Where are you teaching?
I am adrift. I'm the town tramp. I'll just go where they take me. So mostly I'm at the University of San Francisco. Second to that, I'm usually at UC Berkeley, like one or two semesters a year. I've taught at State. I've taught at SFAI. I've taught at CCA. I've taught at Diablo Valley College. I've sort of remote advised students through the Vermont College of Fine Arts program. And I think I'm forgetting something else. And yes, and that's been mostly undergrads, but occasionally graduate advising too.
Do you have any specific stories about your experience teaching high school, like learning moments for you or?
Oh, geez.
Or inspiring young art teacher?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Because you said you learned so much about teaching.
I don't know. I guess sometimes when I hear folks bitching and moaning about their adjunct experiences at college, especially if they're teaching at art school, I actually have very little sympathy. So I have a very unusual tack on the adjunct issue. Which is, you know, you folks are teaching like a bunch of bougie middle-class kids. You've got 10 students in a new genres classroom. You are not working. Like, you're doing a little bit of work for a little bit of pay because you genuinely are doing just a little bit of work. If you know what public school teachers are getting paid and how much they really, really work and care about their students, I'm playing the world smallest violin for some folks. So I'm sort of, what you can't see is that I'm playing the world smallest violin for some folks. So,
and Kate's trying to mic it.
I hope you got that. So I don't know. I think I just worked with some incredible other educators, people who were really dedicated to social justice and really dedicated to sort of to pedagogy and to, yeah, I'm trying to think of other fancy words I can use, but I'm forgetting them. And I just worked with some really amazing students, and I'm super, super duper pissed off at most of them couldn't afford to go on to art schools or, you know, play that game. I'm grateful to know that a lot of them are still in the arts and doing creative things in other ways, though. But, yeah, I think I just worked with such a different mix of folks, and it was such an intense experience, and I was just sort of a flaky mess when I was doing it. That I think just in retrospect, when I look back on that, I'm always grateful for the kinds of experiences I had teaching. It was, and still will probably always be the best job I ever had.
Cool. My brother's a high school teacher.
He's awesome.
He teaches Spanish. Shout out to you, Skid Rhodes.
Skid Rhodes.
My mom, too. How about what's your take on San Francisco? What's happening here? What's going on?
I guess I want to go back to the 89 Quake project I was doing then, just because for me that is like this weird thing of, again, I'd love to talk about this word rupture, but I mean that's the polarizing moment that so much changes. And for any of us who were actually around the Bay Area at the time, because I was actually born here, I've got a weird, complicated backstory of having moved around a lot as a kid, but I've basically lived in the Bay Area my entire life, I mean since my teen years. So I've seen a shit ton of change here. And I think that the ways in which people are lamenting and bemoaning this latest wave of change is, it's real. And the economic, you know, the extreme economic disparity is worse than it's ever been. But I think that this place has always sort of done that. And that's, I mean, something that comes up over and over again, too. But it does keep reinventing itself. And it may not be the way we want it to be reinvented, but it's going to happen. And I guess for me also, having almost always worked in San Francisco, but for a decade I lived in West Oakland, there's a way in which people whine about leaving San Francisco that I also have very little sympathy for. It's not like you're being banished from the Garden of fucking Eden leaving San Francisco,
yeah,
folks.
Right.
East Bay is a lovely, lovely place. And San Franciscans can be total snobs about it. So I'm just saying enjoy it, but don't be lame about it, because especially Oakland has been misunderstood for way too long. It's an amazing, amazing city with actually a lot more, I think, vitality in the arts right now. And I think maybe people just need to sort of embrace that. I know it sucks. I know that a lot of things are happening in terms of the evictions and the price increases in San Francisco that are totally unfair. But I don't know what else to say except make some lemonade. I don't really. I just don't. I think San Francisco may be going to hell in a handbasket, and we're just going to be Twitter Ubered to death. I do feel like there's still hope in the East Bay, folks, and maybe even other places. I think I was listening to you guys brought up Crockett, I think, in one of your earlier podcasts, yeah, and I almost don't want you to – nobody moved to Crockett because I'm going to be in Crockett. I think, you know, it's the natural sort of thing is if all of the financial bullshit is happening sort of south and west, and we all go north and east to get away from it and forge new communities and drill wells and, you know – I don't know. Evict the people who were there before so that we can, you know,
exactly.
Be the next wave of gentrification in a whole new world. Manifest destiny. That wasn't much of a pep talk. I do just feel like the Bay Area community, it will involve more driving, but that's like called Los Angeles. And maybe that's some of the reality of some of this, or we do create little pockets again. And they aren't in San Francisco, and that's just what it is.
Yeah.
Great transit in the East Bay, AC Transit. Get your Clipper card. Mason hates it, but I live by it.
Emory go-round.
You got your Emory go-round.
Emory go-round is a very special, unique thing that I wish more of these fucking tech companies would embrace that model. It's free transit for everyone, not just for their fucking employees. It's amazing.
I just like that it's called the Emory Go-Round.
Yeah, that too.
Wait, can you talk a little bit about your portable toilet project?
Portable toilets are great. Don't you people know that? They're...
I need more information on that.
How can I say other than, they were like these magical objects to me. They feel like the TARDIS, or they feel like these portals to other dimensions, which is just fun for me. But particularly when I was when I moved to Prague for a couple years, and I was kind of lonely in Europe, as one is, I would just see them everywhere, like, but really next to beautiful, majestic monuments. And, you know, that infantile part of me that just loves that moment of, you know, this sort of monument to Western civilization and centuries of, you know, developed whatever. And then there's a crapper next to it. And that's, I think for me, that's sort of that part, that post-colonial part of my brain just finds that endlessly funny. Like, it's just sort of like, it's the potty humor joke that is part of sort of the seat of empire. The seat of empire is, yeah, I never thought of it that way. But yeah, I think just, but I also have a long background as a photographer, so I don't usually, I've never shown formally my, other than the work that happens with the mail order brides, I've never made a habit of exhibiting my photos, but it's definitely a long part of my back training. And so for me, it's a way of working that out, of trying to just come up with interesting juxtapositions and compositions. So probably a little bit of Where's Waldo in there too, because I kind of like to hide the toilets in the compositions sometimes. But yes, at its core for me, it is a weirdly post-colonial project.
And you have a book of those.
Two.
I have two books, and I'm working on my third.
Are they commercially available to the common consumer?
You can buy them on Lulu.com. Look for Portable Toilets of the Western World, Volume 1, and Portable Toilets of the Western World, Volume 2.
And also your nurse's book. Is that also on Lulu.com?
Yes. But there are no portable toilets in that one.
Check out all these projects and more down in the link world. And as always, Wofford,
congratulations.
And thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thank you, and congratulations to you both.
I just wanted to give a little shout out to our friend Dorothy Santos.
Oh, great.
Who I think is doing some really great work. She's finishing up her PhD right now, but she's also been doing some really interesting writing. But she just started a newsletter that I encourage you all to check out. It's it's called Lines, Words, Places, Spaces, and Everything in Between. And then she says, she basically shares what she's reading, her latest art crushes, places she's gone to, where she's going, conversations with brilliant people, questions. She asks her viewers questions to answer at the end, which I think is kind of great. Aww. She's trying to like engage people.
Yeah,
also,
I love that.
Which is really hard.
I'll engage with that.
But it's like, unlike a killer newsletter. Hey, don't give our listeners a hard time.
Listeners.
But her newsletter is tinyletter.com/DorothySantos.
We'll have a link to that.
We'll have a link
there.
Check it out. It's interesting. I was excited about it.
Definitely, I'm sure. It's right up your alley, listener. Whoever you are.
Whoever you are.
Yeah, she's great.
Maybe we should ask our listeners to share newsletters they really love.
Yeah. Listeners, share whatever you want.
Tell us whatever.
Stories, songs, recipes.
I'd actually be interested to know if you have any newsletters that you subscribe to that you're really, really excited about. Or that you put out.
Or if you got good driving directions that people don't know about. Whatever you want to send us, you can send it to congratulationspinetree@gmail.com.
Did you guys get that? Let's do it one more time.
Mason, we got to check that because I think people said they emailed and I haven't gotten anything.
Okay. So you can email us at congratulationspinetree.com. We check that about once a week.
congratulationspinetree@gmail.com.
You can email us.
We said it 50 times.
Or you can call in 419-351.
Mason, that's not helping.
419-351-6606. You can also text that number. Why don't you text? You're texting constantly.
Yeah, you're texting when you're driving. Listeners, get
text
with it.
Text me when you're driving.
Oh, God.
Not really. Oprah, that's pledge.
Oprah pledge.
Oprah, there's a pledge you sign that you'll never text and drive.
Who signs it?
The people do.
The people,
Oprah,
when they go to her show.
You're swearing to Oprah that you won't do
Dear
it.
Dear Oprah,
congratulations. You listened to another episode of the
Congratulations
Haunting of the
Mission Mansion.
Why do you listen to this? Thank you, listeners.
Thank you.
Oh, God. Please cut all that shit out.